All right, so you're listening to this podcast right now, London is Blue, and guess what? We host our podcast on anchor.fm. That's right. If you're looking to host your own podcast, this is the easiest free way to get started. It's got a content creation tool, allows you to record and the podcast right from a phone. That's right. Don't even need a computer, but you can do it there too. They'll also help you distribute it, which is probably the most challenging part. You don't want to have to mess with that. They got you covered. You can get it right on a Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as any other place podcasts are found. And you know what? You can monetize it too. Make a little cash for sharing your great content with the world. It's everything you need to make a podcast all in one individual place. So you know what? Head over to your app store, download the Anchor app, or head to anchor.fm to get started if you're ready to launch your podcast and make it happen.
Hi, this is Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
This is William.
I'm Mason Mount. You're listening to the London is Blue podcast.
And welcome back, Chelsea fans, to part two of our series with Chelsea Youth, talking everything about the young teams outside the first team. If you missed it, we did the dev squad first. You need to go back and listen to that. But it can be after this one. Don't feel like they're in an order by any means. Just don't sleep on it. Joining me again this episode, myself, Brandon, Dan, and Nick coming at you. Nick, skipping over you, going right back to Dan, because Dan, we did the dev squad last time. What are we doing this time?
U18 football. It is time to talk about the bread and butter that our guest just loves to enjoy, loves to talk about, and that, again, is at Chelsea Youth on Twitter, but it is our friend Phil. And Phil, how excited, I guess maybe, you mentioned that the U18s are where you like to talk about, or spend the most time getting into it. Why is that? And why are you maybe more excited for this episode? Not just because it's the second one you're doing with us, but because it's about the U18s.
Yeah, I think it's because you get to see the real start of the journey. Once they get into the under-18s at the age of 16, they've got the scholarship, they're working towards a professional contract, and their career is likely going to be in football in some degree. So it's welcoming another group of boys who are growing into adults, growing into professional footballers, and about to announce themselves on the world. And it's the journey through the academy that really grabs my attention as much as the destination of the first team.
So Phil, we have a very engaged audience who, in our postseason survey, has showed a lot of interest in learning more specifically about the U18s, kind of given some recent rise to the first team from Callum and Reese and all these guys. So, is there a particular kind of method to your madness and how you take in this team, or how you continue to learn and grow your knowledge about the team, so that we might be able to take a couple of notes and grow ourselves this season?
Yeah, I think it's about learning from why things haven't happened as much as why things do happen. So everyone watches the Youth Cup runs and they fall in love with a certain player and think, okay, he's a nailed on first team player. Why doesn't that happen? Is it because the player doesn't progress as well as he might have? Is it because the pathway isn't there? Is it just because he was a fantastic 17-year-old footballer and happened to peak there? There are so many unknowns at that age. And the average age of a Premier League debutant from academy football now is somewhere like 22 years of age. So we're talking 5 or 6 years worth of development. So it's perfectly fine to be encouraged and excited about what you see from these guys, but they're at the start of their journey. There's a lot that can happen to them as they grow off the pitch as much as on the pitch.
What would you say is the biggest first hurdle going into the U18s that, maybe a player... in the dev squad episode, we talked about maybe some of the pace of getting accustomed to it is the challenge for a dev squad into the first team and the expectations there. But from a player who's progressing from U14, U16 into U18, what's their first initial challenge? Is it, again, pace, or is there something new there?
It's predominantly about adapting to life as a full-time footballer. The Elite Player Performance Plan, which is the sort of centralized document that governs youth football in England that's been in effect since 2013, gave clubs the ability to take control of the education of their players. So some clubs will have an arrangement with a school in local proximity. Some will take it on site. Chelsea, for example, have an association with Glynn School, which is a few miles away from the training ground. They will have teachers come to the training ground and do 4 or 5 hours a day of schoolwork for players up from the age of 14, 15, 16. split with time on the training pitch. So essentially for those guys, they become full-time footballers or full-time at the training ground from the age of 15. But not everybody does that. Either they're not offered the opportunity to by the club, or the family and the club are happy with their current school arrangements. So at that point, they do what's called the day release program. They'll come to the training ground 1 or 2 days a week out of their school and then return. So a bunch of those guys, when they sign the scholarships and spend full-time life at the club, that's the adaptation they have to do. They move away from home. They move in with a Diggs family or a Villette, as it is in Canada, or whatever it is in your local terminology. They live with a foster family, usually along with another teammate. They get their own independence, but they move away from home at 16, which is uncommon for most people. People go away to college or university at 18 in most walks of life. These guys are doing it a couple of years earlier and all the while have to continue developing as a footballer. It's the off the pitch stuff that really affects how the journey goes from that point of view.
You know, I think that one of the things that we talked about a little bit before we jumped live was kind of just the, I would say, like the perspective of the academy, right? Or how it's viewed as an asset or resource to the club. And in the past, there's been a lot of frustration because that walk across the road has seemed impassable, almost just not something that anyone really did, let alone consistency. We've already seen photos, clips, Frank's there, Jody's there, Christensen's there, Aspie's there, all the, you know, a bunch of first team players, Mount's there, as well as the coaching staff. What, I guess, you know, I'm struggling to even like put it into words, like what the difference is from the last, and I don't know, 5, 6, 10, 12, whatever number of years it's been, to overnight with Frank and Jody, you know, coming in. What's that been like?
I think the best word is from our friend Liam Toomey, who wrote about it in The Athletic this morning. He said the word that keeps coming back to him from people he speaks to is galvanized. Everyone in the academy building suddenly knows that their work is appreciated that little bit more on the other side of the road with people they know they're friends with and that they've worked with for several years. Someone like Joe Edwards, who's now on the coaching staff, has been involved with the academy in some way for the best part of 25 years now. So having them come to watch matches, having them interact with the staff on a regular basis, being able to be on first name terms with the academy players, it just lifts everybody's spirits and makes them think that the work that they're doing is that little bit more likely to pay dividends.
I think, you know, just hearing it that way, and, you know, I love that you talked about Liam, because we're huge fans of him and have read his articles on The Athletic as well. You know, it helps, because I think that maybe a lot of us international fans just haven't been there when the academy maybe had a bigger role. We've been here in the era where we go and buy continental superstars and players, and we are able to rest our hat on JT being there, right? But, you know, like I said, I think it's just a good perspective to always ask, as, you know, you've mentioned you've been a fan since birth of Chelsea. It's just, I think it's so important to get that perspective versus kind of where we're coming from.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily believe that you can only have the culture of Chelsea running through it through academy graduates. We were blessed with one of the finest generations of footballers to come through the Stamford Bridge doors in its history. We had Drogba, we had Ballack, we had Essien, we had any number of players, Ricardo Carvalho, Ashley Cole. None of those came through the academy, but they all understood what it was to be Chelsea. If you go back and speak to any of them, you'd probably find that John Terry was the one setting the example, telling them what Chelsea meant to be Chelsea. And when he decided to leave or wasn't offered a new contract, I think a part of the heart of the club disappeared with it. And maybe we're finally finding a little bit more of that back with Frank coming back to the club, with the academy graduates on and off the pitch. And the results will come in time. But it's about finding a little bit more of what Chelsea is again.
We mentioned that. I think we talk about that as fans and supporters often, is what it means to be Chelsea. When these U18s, U15s, you know, get that type of education around like what the Chelsea DNA is, how does that get quantified to them? How is that showcased to them so that when they do make that transition from U18 to U23, U23 to first team, that they really have that level of understanding, or what is that actual, is there a way to quantify that or to talk about it, you know, to actually give it a little bit more of just a definition?
It's always a hard one to quantify something as abstract as that, but I think maybe it's the sort of the pride of playing for Chelsea, what wearing that shirt and wearing that badge means, not to you necessarily, but to the people who pay money to come to the matches, the people that are investing their time in you. People get hung up on whether so-and-so is a Chelsea fan or isn't a Chelsea fan. Mason Mount grew up a Portsmouth fan, but is Chelsea, because he's been there since the age of six, he feels a certain level of pride and of care in what he does for Chelsea. And that message passes its way through the academy from Neil Barth on downwards, because of the very deliberate strategy of surrounding the team and the coaching staff with players who've been in the academy or have been through the academy, made the first team journey and returned to pass on their wisdom.
So, you know, I think another one of those structural changes, and to kind of wrap on this, is the fact that Chelsea is not only kind of, you know, reimagining what the pathway is to the first team, but they're also, I think, doing a better and maybe more clever job of exposing the masses to these matches. So whether it's to the Fistand app or through you know, Facebook live streams or whatever, there seems to be more free access to see these guys play, especially if we're not sitting next to you in the stadium. So could you maybe talk a little bit about that and how that exposure could help grow the profile of the U18s?
It's a little bit of a double-edged sword, because more exposure leads to perhaps a little bit more hype, a little bit more misunderstood hype, because people are watching it as a match in isolation without realizing that these are 16 and 17 year olds who aren't the 1% of the 1% who go on and be superstars at that age. But I think a lot of clubs can do more to bring their fans closer to that sort of thing. If it's not the under 18s, then you can definitely show regular under 23 football. It certainly hasn't harmed Manchester United over the 25 years or whatever that they've had MUTV. They regularly show their under 18s of a Saturday morning. They've been the leader in English youth development for some 50 to 60 years now. And as long as you surround the coverage with education, I think it can only really be a net positive. But you have to, you can't just leave it out there in isolation and have people run wild with various opinions and hot takes.
It's exactly the same reason, and we've talked about American football before we started recording. It's the exact same reason we don't see JV or high school football matches broadcast on ESPN with a high level of regularity, is that there has to be some level of tempering of the expectation. But as we, you know, maybe pivot a little bit here and talk about the setup of the U18 squad this season, they also have a new coach. So Ed Brand joins as the new U18 head coach. So he's formerly youth team captain as a player. He's 32-year-old. He's been coaching in our academy for 10 years. And so most recently he was the assistant to Edwards with the development squad last season. And he also worked with Morris during the two-year period in which the team won every competition they entered, which is quite a run. So what should we know about Brand beyond maybe just the bio that Chelsea puts on their website?
Yeah, he's been an assistant more than he's been a lead. We go back 5 or 6 years, he was the under-12s head coach with James Simmons as his assistant, and now they're both in the same positions with the under-18s. But people will mostly know Ed for being Jody's assistant and Joe's assistant, where, amongst many other things, he's often tasked with opposition analysis and working out how to play against the teams upcoming. That's a very high level of responsibility. A lot of the coaching strategy at the club is collaborative. The assistants are entrusted with a lot of important stuff on day-to-day basis. So when they get to be the lead, they're well prepared for what they have to do. The responsibility falls on them a little bit more. But he's got James Simmons alongside him. James was the head coach of the under-16s last season, so the dozen first-year scholars that have now joined the squad, James knows a little bit more about those than Ed. But yeah, It's an opportunity for Ed to carry on developing his career. He deserves the opportunity of being a head coach in his own right, and I think he started the season very well.
And how consistent has that, since you've been watching the academy, how consistent has been the promotion of the coach along with the aging up of the players. It seems like that adds a high level of continuity and maybe helps to, again, be that elevator versus being the stairs in terms of helping with the players' progression as well.
Yeah, it's certainly become a little bit more prevalent in the last few years. I think Jody did it. I think Joe may have done it before him. And even AD Vivash back before that had worked with the younger age groups. It's a level of familiarity that the players are immediately comfortable with the coach and his particular styles or idiosyncrasies or anything that stands out about them. The players are already familiar with it. It's a mutually beneficial relationship. And it's also in part because Neil Barth's coaching, I wouldn't say coaching mantra, but start mantra with the staff is to encourage them to progress just as much as the players. Take them up the rungs of the UEFA coaching badges up to UEFA Pro. Take them from under 18s to under 23s and then to the first team coaching staff, which is something we saw a lot under Jose Mourinho. He took on Steve Clarke as his first assistant way back in 2004. We had the likes of Chris Jones and Glenn Driscoll become fitness coaches and physios over there. Eva Carneiro went from the under 18s through the system and became the first team doctor. And it dried up a little bit in recent years, but we've had an explosion this summer and we've got 7 or 8 on the first team staff now.
You know, it's probably on purpose, but every time you read a bio of a new Chelsea coach, like, yep, let's see, they've been coaching for the last 10 years in the academy at all levels. Oh, by the way, they were a schoolboy playing at Chelsea, you know, made appearances. And it's just great. You know, like I said, we haven't always heard about it, but the club are really making an effort to say, hey, here's our new staff and here's where they've been through Chelsea. Here's their journey. And it's just so, so great to hear and to see because, you know, especially as international fans, we had no idea, right? The riches and the luxuries that Chelsea have had, especially with a lot of these, you know, coaching staff and players over the years. So, again, just me shouting out the club for doing that. So let's go ahead and look into last season's performance. So as we are in the South Division, okay, which puts us in a league of 12 teams. And here are the final spots from last year. So on top, Arsenal on 60 points, then Tottenham, then Chelsea. So literally the worst kind of order we could go so far. Chelsea were on 44 points, so 16 behind league leaders, table toppers. Then you've got Southampton, Brighton, Villa, Leicester, West Ham, Fulham, Reading, Swansea, and Norwich. So again, kind of the exact same follow-up question as last time, Phil. What are your thoughts? To me, this seems like a little bit of an underachieving. I'm a casual fan. Just pay attention to the headlines. What is your expert opinion and kind of what was your breakdown of maybe why it was good or bad?
Yeah, it's obviously going to look a little bit of a disappointment because Chelsea had won this South League for the previous 4 seasons and the previous 2 they'd won the national title. So the winner of the South plays the winner of the North in a title playoff. They beat Manchester United in the final the previous year, came into it as defending champions and finished 16 points short of Arsenal, who were eventual runners-up to Derby County. So it's, you look at the table, Chelsea lost 4 matches. 2 of those were to Tottenham, 1 was to Arsenal, 1 was to Brighton. In any ordinary season, they might have been a little bit more competitive. The Arsenal team in particular were a powerhouse of a team. They only dropped 6 points in the league all season. They averaged 4 goals a match. And it all comes back to age. So we touched upon a little bit earlier about the challenges some players face when they move into under 18 football because they have to learn about going full time. The majority of players from last year's intake of first year scholars were doing that. There were only 1 or 2 of them who'd been through the school system at Cobham and had been essentially full time for 1 or 2 beforehand. So they came in with a little bit more learning to do than your average youth teamer does now. And they were having to compete against an Arsenal and a Tottenham squad that were loaded with talent in their second year. So they were 17 to turn 18 later in the season. You look at the numbers, Chelsea used 20% more first-year players than the league average over the entire season. Arsenal won the division with exactly 50% of their playing time minutes going to their second-year's players. And Tottenham had 65%. So we're talking maybe 1 or 2 of age difference, but in academy football, that age difference, it shows a lot more. In the senior game, you can be a 20-year-old coming up against a 30-year-old, but the baseline talent in senior football is a lot higher than the baseline talent in academy football. You can be a guy in academy football who's not going to have a playing career coming up against someone like Callum Hudson-Odoi, who will be playing for England within 2 years. And it's a little bit more pronounced. So they were battling off the pitch and then encountering significant challenges on it.
So, I mean, when you look at the table, you know, Chelsea were quite a bit off the mark. What do you think, you know, if anything, Chelsea need to break their way this year to kind of be in the running for a title? Or is that Arsenal team still just too stacked for the competition?
No, you see, that's the thing. That Arsenal team have now graduated. They're off into under 23 football. Quite a few of them are on the verges or have made first team debuts in the Europa League last season. And the same with Tottenham. That's played out already, because in the 10 matches combined that those two clubs have had this season, they've only won 3 matches. Whereas Chelsea have won 4 and drawn 1 of their 5 so far. They're joint top with Brighton, who they drew with yesterday as we record this, and with Fulham, who have started the season exceptionally well themselves. So already Chelsea have an advantage over Arsenal and Tottenham of a few points. That's going to sort of play itself out. They still have to play each other home and away. But as far as I'm concerned, this particular group of Chelsea players that have come into the squad this year to supplement those who played last year are as good as there are in the country, and they should be seen as favourites to reclaim the Southern League title this season.
Well, let's dive into that current squad or that current youth team. So we'll run down the list. We've got goalkeepers. We have Jake Askew. We've got Lucas Bergstrom. We have Ethan Awadi. We go to defenders, quite a bunch here. Jordan Aina, Josh Brooking, James Clark, Levi Colwill. We have Pierre Emile Ikwa Elimbi. We have Bashir Humphreys, Valentino, Leva Ramento. We have Sam McClelland. We have Dinel Simeu, Charlie Wiggett. Midfielders, Lewis Bate, Ben Elliott, Joe Haig. We have Henry Lawrence, Miles Peart Harris. We've got Dion Ronchini. We have Xavier Simmons. And then forwards, we have Tierno Balo. We have Armando Broja, Marcel Lewis, and George Noon.
Yeah, and 12 of those are the new first-year scholars who've come in, having really only experienced success in the last few years. So James Simmons was their manager at under-15 and under-16 level, and is now their assistant manager. As under-15s, they secured a domestic treble. They won an international tournament, the Floodlit Cups regional southern stage, and then the Floodlit Cups national final against Aston Villa. Then as under-16s last year, they won the Premier League Under-16 Cup, which is probably the most prestigious competition at that age group domestically. They played Arsenal in the final of that away from home. They won 5-2. They were dominant from start to finish. They've got England internationals at under-16, under-17 age levels, wherever you look. And they've come in and they've looked straight at home at under-18 level.
So, you know, we're thinking about players specifically. I mean, Armando Broja was a guy that we, you know, mentioned in the U23 episode as a guy who has had to kind of, you know, due to depth issues or due to injuries, kind of move up to the U23s and play a couple of games. He started the season with 6 goals in 5 matches, and then, you know, kind of made it through some tough times last season, but, you know, enjoyed a really strong summer with Albania at the U19 and U21 levels. So, talk to us a little bit about his game and what we might expect from him this season.
Yeah, he's a really well-built, prototypical number 9, big, tall center forward. And it didn't really work out for him last season. He played a little bit too often on the right of the attack, whether it was a 4-3-3 or a 3-4-3 or whatever designation you want to call it. He was a little bit wide. He only scored twice. And George Nunn, who was a fellow first year, came down from Crewe Alexandra. He scored 9 goals and tended to be the preferred centre forward in the team. And we went into sort of the end of season internationals in May and June, and Armando was playing for Albania, scored a few goals for the under-19s and got an immediate promotion up to the under-21s for a doubleheader against Wales. He scored 3 goals in those 2 matches and came back into pre-season at Chelsea with a bit of form and a bit of confidence behind him. And there's growing up off the pitch to do as well. He's gone through a first full season of being a full-time footballer. He's come into the pre-season this year, scored goals while playing up with the under-23s, comes back down, plays against Leeds in pre-season, scores a hat-trick, and then 6 goals in 5 matches at the start of the season proper. He's been a menace to play against. He's grown up. He's still offside way too often. which is something that you can see Ed Brand frustrated about on a weekly basis. But he's learning. He's getting the opportunity at under 23 level. He leads the team as much for his work rate as he does for his goals. And it's that sort of understanding that some players might not hit their stride until their second year, rather than expecting them to be superstars as soon as they come into the under-18 team.
What percentage of this team do you feel like will make some appearance just due to squad depth in the U23s this season? And how important is that being balanced with in that first-year scholarship with really kind of establishing a comfort as that full-time footballer?
We've already seen Brozier and Ballo, Marcel Lewis and Henry Lawrence all play up at that level this season. Henry scored against Brighton on Friday night at Stamford Bridge. And they're the more experienced second years of this group who've already stepped up. The likes of Sam McClelland and Danel Simiu and Pierre Ekwa will probably follow later in the season. Pierre actually played a couple of matches last season, but those were more born out of circumstance and players who were unavailable due to other commitments. What tends to happen with these guys as they come to the end of their 2 years in the youth team is they'll start to be slowly drip fed into the under 23s and expose them a little bit more towards the end of that season so that they can come in for the new season as under 19s ready to be full-time contributors there. But also, we shouldn't forget that Tino Angerin and Ian Matson are technically second years by age group and have already graduated onto much bigger things.
So another couple names I think we want to pull out are Dion and Lewis. So I don't want to steal, your thunder from what you put in here, but it definitely sounds like in the early part of the season, they've really shown themselves to be exciting players.
They have. It's hard to sort of pick out two or three of them because they've all come in and, for the most part, slotted in seamlessly as if they've played 10, 20, 30 matches at this level. But Lewis in particular, he got 6 or 7 matches last season playing up as a schoolboy. He runs the show from sort of defensive midfield. He's small. He's a little bit stocky. He's left-footed. He's always on the move. He's a metronome. He'll pick up the ball, he'll spread it, he'll switch the play. There's a little bit of George McEachran to him, but with more aggression. I think if long-term followers of the youth team remember Connor Clifford from the sort of 2007-2008 time, there are some stylistic similarities to him, only Lewis is left-footed. He's already contributed a few goals and assists. He's a real leader and wants to have the responsibility on his shoulders. And Dion is... he's a little bit like Tarik Lamptey in that he's most at home playing somewhere along the right wing and bombing up and down, taking people out of the game with his sheer pace. But Brighton yesterday, before he went off injured at half-time, he was playing as a sort of a number 10 tucked in the 3-4-3 because his ability to operate in tight spaces and to provide creativity through give and go or being able to beat a man 1v1 seems to be more effective in central areas right now, especially because the team's also got Valentino Livramento to play on the right. So if you can have both of these players in the team at the same time, you can reap the rewards of having two high-level academy players on the pitch at the same time.
So how is Brand typically set up, like formation and terms of getting the best out of the squad that he has? Like, what has his kind of formation or kind of tactical instructions been to the team?
This season, it's been pretty much a 3-4-3 as the first team used against Wolves this weekend, which will be heavy use of wing-backs, two sort of attacking midfielders behind a central striker or just alongside them. They're very versatile. They're very fluid. This particular group have played that way, 3-4-3, for the last couple of years. More than anything else, I'd say that Brand and the coaching staff are adaptable to what they have. This squad is perfectly suited to playing in a 3-4-3. But if they didn't have the options to, then they wouldn't. They started preseason playing with a back four. So they'll adjust as required, but when everybody's available, there's no reason not to use wingbacks right now.
Is there a defender that you're looking at, either a wingback or someone who would slot into a back three that you're thinking could make a huge jump outside of who we've talked about already?
Probably Valentino Livramento, which is a very Italian name for a South London-born boy, but I believe he has Italian family. He's nominally a right wing back, can play on the left wing back, has played on the right side of a back three, more to the degree that Azpilicueta has done it than Reece James, because he's not as physically developed as Reece is. He's got the same sort of build as Azpi. He's got the same metronomic energy up and down the right wing, takes the responsibility on his shoulders to play, to lead the team. He played in the UEFA Youth League last season as a schoolboy, admittedly just in a second leg of a match that Chelsea had won comfortably in the first leg. But he's ready to lead, to be a key player in the Youth Cup run this season. And I'm not going to go as far as saying he'll play in the first team in X number of years, but he's definitely a prospect to keep an eye on.
That is good to know. Another name that we didn't kind of put down here, but you know, I'm interested to hear your thoughts, is just Marcel Lewis is another one that I think has popped across your tweets occasionally. And I'm wondering, how would you assess his kind of contributions to the team so far and what you see for him?
Yeah, I think he's fairly understated because he doesn't score a great amount of goals and he doesn't always end up with the highest number of assists, but he's always there involved in something. I made the point on Friday night against Brighton that despite scoring a goal, his defensive work was tremendous. He was working from the number 10 position, but he'd be back on the edge of his own box, winning tackles, just winning 50-50 duels, the little things that keep you in possession and keep the play ticking over. And his work rate sets the tone for everything else. He's not a shouty leader. He's not someone who's going to lead with authority. But there were times last season when he was playing with Nunn and with Tiano Ballo as part of a front three where their work rate off the ball caused teams so many problems. And he'll come along. He's, again, 5'8", maybe 5'7". He's not the biggest. Very, very adept technically. Very good free kick taker. But he's rounding out his game really impressively right now.
Okay. Well, how about we go ahead and jump into the, like I said, young, but, you know, current season so far. Again, South Conference, we've got five matches played as well. So the table looks Fulham on top with 13 points. They are tied with Brighton and Chelsea. So that is the top three, all tied on 13 points. Chelsea, as with the other teams, have 4 wins, 1 draw, no losses, and Chelsea are plus 4 goal difference. Then in fourth, you've got West Ham, then Villa, then Tottenham, then Reading, Leicester, Arsenal, Swansea, Southampton, Norwich. This just goes to show you, Phil, as you said, Arsenal were so dominant last season. They were head and shoulders above the rest. I think their goal difference, and I didn't touch on this, blew me away, plus 63, okay? That's a hell of a lot of goals and not a lot of matches. And look, now they're in ninth out of 12. And so it's great to see Chelsea in third, essentially tied on top of the table.
It is, and it comes with the asterisk that we've only played 5 matches out of 22, but that is a quarter of the season. So Arsenal have transitioned off to a whole new bunch of players that have come into the team. They're less experienced and they might be stronger again next season. Chelsea have got the likes of Broja, likes of Marcel Lewis, likes of Pierre Aqua, who've had a year in the team, but it's been mostly the first years who've come into the team and really led by example. They've probably had a slightly harder start by comparison to Fulham and Brighton, but that's not to discredit either of those teams. Brighton looked a very, very good team when they hosted Chelsea yesterday morning. They were good for the point that they earned in the end, and they probably should have won late on. Chelsea's goal difference is a little bit shy right now because of the way they started the season. They've had a harder fixture list. I'd be surprised if they didn't improve that in the weeks and months to come.
When you look at the maybe some of the challenges or the teams that will maybe give us a little bit of a headache, you know, obviously the table is a little different in PL2 or with the U18s. You know, we see teams like Reading on this list, Swansea, who are not maybe Premier League teams currently, Fulham. Who looks to be maybe the most challenging competition that we're going to face this season? And is there any maybe surprise team that we would kind of have to worry about that's really going to challenge us on our way to try to win it all?
I think Brighton and Fulham could each emerge as the surprise team. Brighton probably more so because they don't have a great track history in youth development. The people would be surprised to learn that they've got a very, very impressive academy. They've been making great strides. Their under-16s last season were national semi-finalists, and they've come into this team and led them to a pretty good start. They've got an expansive recruitment program across Europe, and it brings in players that supplement that. Fulham have always been really good at youth level. Whether their best players have been taken or not, Harvey Elliott would have been part of this team and was part of this team before he went to Liverpool. I'd be surprised if over the course of the season Arsenal and Tottenham didn't get it together enough to challenge for top three positions, because ultimately the size and recruitment power of the big three down south will always play out. But Fulham and Brighton have definitely got it in them to make life hard for Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, I think on that note, when we kind of think about season predictions, how do you think, you know, you kind of already alluded to this, but how do you think the team will finish in the division? And then will they move on to win any silverware kind of beyond the South Division?
I'm very bullish on the chances of this team to win the Southern League title at the very least. I think that they've got an array of options. Whatever your preferred type of player is, this team has it. They've got options in depth. They can solve problems. They've got different formations, tactical approaches. They'll get the job done. And I think they'll go well in the Youth Cup again. Obviously, you can get the luck of the draw like we did last season, drew Manchester United in the third round, lost by the odd goal in seven to a world-class youngster in Mason Greenwood. You can never quite guarantee that you're going to get a smooth path to the final, but I'd be surprised if they weren't in the mix for silverware again. It looks like the North section is already being dominated by Manchester City. They're scoring 3, 4, 5 goals a match. They've got a very good generation of players coming back again, so we could get to next April and May and have a bit of a renewal of acquaintances with them.
At this level, do you feel like this, you know, when you look at, you know, the U18 teams and the academies, you know, if you were kind of to go and maybe rank them, you know, I feel like maybe without, you know, without bias, you might be able to say Chelsea won. But who are, you know, maybe if you were to rank them, maybe top three, top five, where do you kind of gauge the level of a U18 squad across these Premier League sides?
For the most part, Chelsea are as good as anybody. It can fluctuate a bit year by year in terms of playing talent, but in terms of strength of academy, the clubs are mostly being audited again over the coming season so that it can be recategorized where necessary. But Chelsea have always been in the top cluster of teams with Arsenal, with Manchester City, Manchester United, Liverpool, Tottenham. Those are the leading academies just because of the investment they're able to put in. From any year to year, you'd expect those teams to be up at the top, which is why it was really impressive that Derby County managed to win the national title last season, overcoming some of the powerhouses in the north and then winning against that dominant Arsenal team quite comprehensively in the final. Year on year, Chelsea are going to be up there. They're going to produce some of the best players around, and that's not going to change in the near future.
A quick follow would be, do you see the gap, you know, because Chelsea have been pretty dominant for quite some time. Do you see that gap closing now, or is it still a little ways to go?
In the south, it's probably more pronounced between Arsenal, Tottenham and Chelsea and everybody else. It's hard for any team to close that gap particularly. And it's similar in the north. You'll have the two Manchester clubs, Liverpool and Everton. They'll always do well. And over the course of the last 6 years, the all-played table shows that out, that these teams will always win the majority of their 22 league matches and they'll be in the business end of the Youth Cup. It's been the last time a team from outside of those six teams won the Youth Cup was when Norwich beat Chelsea back in 2013. It's once in a generation where that happens.
So, you know, in really tying all these pieces together, I think the academy probably has a couple roles for the club. Obviously, to produce talent for the first team. But, I mean, there's also the side of the revenue, right? Of, hey, they're not good enough for Chelsea, but it doesn't mean they're not good enough overall, right? And so I guess I'm always interested in kind of, I guess I'm interested in your perspective on, I guess, has this perspective changed over the years, or maybe one has been more important than the other, and just kind of how it all fits into how the club operates, you know, almost from like the 30,000 foot view. If we step out and say, all right, the club is this huge entity, there's all these moving parts. How does Academy fit into like the big picture for Chelsea?
As a bit of a traditionalist, I'd always say that the Academy should be producing players for the first team, which is what it's doing this season, but it clearly hasn't done that often enough over the years. So you make of it what you can. If you're producing talented players who might not be of a Chelsea standard, whatever the bar is for entry on any given season, then if you can turn a profit on them, the work isn't going to waste. There, every penny helps with financial fair play. And while Michael Emanolo hasn't been at the club for the last 3 years, it was sort of his drive that expanded the loan army operation, which is where the big money's made from that. The academy developed players who go out on loan, you'll make a little bit off them in terms of loan fee and wage contributions, and then a fee if they graduate and they at a different level to Chelsea's first team. But I tend to think that the players that you're developing for the club should be for the club.
All right. And then obviously I know there's some requirements, and there are some, you know, I guess like FA is very involved in these academies as far as like how their development, the standards, the structure and things like that. So obviously it's good to see, but I know that a lot of teams kind of come up and down outside the table. I guess this is just for me. Is it always Premier League teams in their academies, or are there times where our academies will actually play a championship team because their academy is so much better in comparison than maybe their first team?
Yeah, the categorization of academies is done as part of an audit that looks at the investment, the scholarly education, the track record of developing players and producing them from the club. There's five or six different categories that they go through. And if you fall into the top 24 as it is, then you get to play alongside the elite academies in the country. So you see that the likes of Reading and Swansea are in the southern section at the minute. Derby County are in the northern section. There's the majority of the Category 1 academies are Premier League clubs, but there are championship clubs in there. There are Premier League clubs who play at Category 2 level, which they play against other Championship and League 1 academies. It's done in such a way that you can have a club like Reading, who have a great track record of youth development in recent years, but the first team fortunes haven't quite been able to keep them in the Premier League. It allows them to still develop their players at the highest possible level.
Okay, we're going to make a quick transition back into predictions here. Who is likely of this group of talented youngsters to be the top goal scorer for the season?
Well, since Armando Broja's already got 6 goals, he's got quite a head start on anybody else. It should be him. If he moves on at sort of mid-season and starts to play more regularly for the development squad, then someone like George Nunn will have an opportunity to lead the line like he did last year. He scored 9 goals. He looked pretty good last season. There's a bit of a Patrick Bamford vibe about him. He's a left-footed striker. He's blonde. So you've got the visual similarities, but they move in a similar way. They've got the same sort of demeanour. He's got goals in him, so if he gets the opportunity to lead the line more regularly, then he could catch up.
And who do you think is most likely to be, again, it might be half seasons at the U18 level, but the maybe the first half player of the season and maybe the whole player of the season, given the mobility between squads at the young levels?
It would probably be a first year who spends the entire season with the squad who's going to win the award. The Premier League has a Scholar of the Year award for every club. Henry Lawrence won that last year. That's largely due to the work they do off the pitch as well as on the pitch. And so without the exposure to knowing how they're getting on that side of it, we can only focus on the playing side. I like Lewis Bates' chances. He's a real influence in the team. He started well. He'll be there from start to finish.
So, like I said, I think this has just been, in summation, really great perspective on a lot of these different things. But I do want to go ahead and just wrap this up. So, again, Phil, this two-parter that we've done on the U18 team right now, the dev squad / lone army, you know, in the other episode, it has been fantastic. So, again, if you're not following at Chelsea Youth, do it. And, you know, give them a shout. Tell them how much you enjoyed it. But again, just thank you for the time and sharing this. Our strategy this year has been much more, we want to be much more comprehensive of the club and not just focus on the first team. So we did a women's preview and now we're doing the youth stuff with you. And so again, just thank you, because there are so many fans outside of England that are just unfamiliar with this stuff. The level of knowledge you bring to it is fantastic.
Thank you guys for having me on. It's obviously the first time I've been on a podcast with anybody. I'm sure it won't be the last, and I'm sure I'll be back with you guys at some point throughout the season.
Would love to get updates throughout the season, if at all possible. Nick and Dan, I'll each allow you one kind of final note or thank you as well. So, Nick, yeah, you're right.
You are now Professor Phil to me. I think it's just been awesome. The perspective of someone who goes week in and week out is always welcome on this show, and you know, something that, you know, again, we're just we're growing in our fandom, not of just, you know, the first team, which we feel pretty well versed in at this point, but for the women's team and the youth team, and this is awesome perspective so that we can do that. So just wanted to shout you out there, Professor.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm in a fairly privileged position to be able to see what other people can't or that don't have the opportunity. So it's predominantly been the Twitter account, but if I can help bring a little bit more exposure to things and offer a bit more insight, then I'm more than glad to.
Well, we are very fortunate for you passing your knowledge to us and in turn giving it back to the larger Chelsea community. I think that, you know, it's been very great to see this season the excitement around a Tammy, a Mason, a Reese, and to see how that's going to continue to evolve throughout this season with the Carabao Cup matches and what this U23 team can do, what this U18 team can do, and how this Chelsea DNA is just, it's, you know, pumping through the blood of every one of these players and these coaches. And I don't think I can remember a more exciting moment, maybe outside of winning the Champions League in modern Chelsea history than I do right now.
Yeah, everyone's got their own reasons for excitement around the first team, but this is definitely the best I felt about things in years.
Awesome. Love it. Well, again, thank you so much. Chelsea fans, go give them some love. But we will be back with a ton more content. So until next time, Chelsea fans, you know what to do. Keep the blue flag flying high.